me today is July 19, 1985. Mark Wagner. I'm talking with Halsey Reinhardt here in his house in Rockbridge, Wisconsin. Halsey, you said you'd talk a while today about Rockbridge, the characters, the businesses, the town.
Maybe I should start as my first recollections of it as a little boy going with my grandpa up to the post office. Was one of the events of the day. And at that time, the post office is in what was the Oddfellows building, which on the front of it said it had been built, I think, in 1882. And the downstairs had been built to be rented out as a grocery store or a general store. I guess you don't use the word grocery in conjunction with country stores of that time because they're general stores. And in fact, it said boots and shoes across the front. And so that was one of the things that they sold at this store. But it also contained the post office for many years. I'll tell later of the later post office as I remembered as a boy. But as a very, very little boy, this post office was in the Oddfellows building. And across the long porch that was across the front of it sat quite a collection of retired citizens, many of them Civil War veterans, and some of them were quite unique characters. And as a little boy, I was a little afraid to go to the post office alone, because one particular old man who was my grandfather Carpenter's buddy when he was in the Civil War, his name was Newton Chismore. He and Grandpa had gone through the whole war together. They had enlisted together and walked to Lone Rock to join the Army, and had gone in about 1864 and had gone together with General Sherman from Atlanta to the sea. And they had a lot of instances and stories to tell. There were also the Banker brothers, who were war veterans, who sat there that were cantankerous little old men who had a little different point. Each had a different point of view politically, and once in a while they would get disturbed with each other, and they'd have to separate them because they would swing at each other with their canes. But there was Homer Carter, who carried the mail. Homer had several vehicles that he carried the mail in. He had a buggy, and he had a road cart. And the store was the kind of store you would expect, that had a big coffee mill with probably 3-foot flywheels on it, and a great big dome in which you could put 3 or 4 or 5 pounds of coffee in. And as a remembrance of my boyhood, nothing smelled as good as to go in the store when they were grinding coffee. I haven't been a great coffee drinker in life, but the aroma of coffee just gets to me, and it just takes me back to the days when I used to go to the post office with Grandpa. I was afraid of Newt Chismore because he was a tall man and he had a cane with a crook on it. And just about the time I got out of reach, which I got out of reach about as quick as possible, Newt would reach out with his long crooked cane like a shepherd's crook and hook me around the neck and pull me back over a little closer. Not that he was going to do me any damage at all, but he just liked to tease me as a little boy. So I remember him very well. One of the things, of course, that was always so prevalent there was the hitching rack and the hitching post and the different horses that were tied up, because this was perhaps 1917, and there were almost no cars at that time. There were the Jess Huffman, who operated the garage, which was built about that time, was the only man who could fix automobiles. And he had his garage built right next to the Oddfellows building. And he had one gasoline pump. And he would, the main repair that had to be made on the Model T Fords was to put in a new set of, as they said, bands. And these were they had planetary transmissions, which were far, far, far ahead of their time. in which a tight band was snuggled up around a drum, which in turn caused planetary gears inside the drum to revolve, and you had high and low and reverse simply by the pedal you pushed and the band that you tightened up around this revolving drum to slow it down or to entirely stop it so that the internal planetary gears would turn. Well, those bands would get loose, and then you'd have to tighten the bands. They were just a like a brake band with a lining, and you'd have to pull the bands out, and you would have to put the new bands in and retighten it. So one of the things that was always happening up at the garage was somebody was getting their bands retightened. And another thing that had to be checked periodically was the magneto points. Now, the original Model T Fords the very first ones didn't even have electric ignition, except as it came from this magneto. And the magneto, which, as you visualize the magnetos on tractors, are little compact things. This was a whole series of magnets that were fastened to the big flywheel that went past a coil, and the magneto points reached down and picked the charge off of that, and then it went through a timer into each one of the four cylinders. So you were always having to have your magneto points fixed. So those were the two of the things that Jess Huffman in his garage was had a great deal to do. Another, if you overhauled a motor, you didn't dare take the motor out and just get everything ready and started, as we do today. It had to be broken in. So in one end of his garage, he had a great big motor sat on a frame. And when your motor was repaired, new piston rings put in and new bearings put in, as quite often happened to the old Model T, you had to take the motor out and connect it with this big motor and let it run it over for an hour without being started. And then you could put the motor back in your car, and the bearings were worn in and tightened and checked, and everything was ready to put it in a drive. A whole different concept of overhaul than we have at the present time. Many times the headlights had to be repaired, because the headlights were also connected to this magneto. So if you were driving down the road with your car and you slowed the motor down, your lights would go down dimmer and dimmer and dimmer till you hardly had a beam. But if you speeded up the motor, your lights would flare up real bright, and if you happened to over-accelerate your motor, you gave the bulbs a little too much juice, and many times they burned out. So the garage man had quite a few built-in projects that he could work on. One of the mail carriers at that time, besides Homer Carter, was Jim Holloway. And Jim was a character that I always remember very much. He was a short, broad-shouldered, heavy-necked man who must have had strong genes inherited from somewhere and passed them on, because I see his descendants, and they are the physical patterns of old Jim. They're short and they're heavy set, and they have broad shoulders and they have heavy necks, and they look very much like old Jim did. And Jim was given to exaggeration somewhat, not given to lying, just simply over accenting the obvious. As the time that there was a big high water came down Pine River Valley here, and Jim passing the news to everybody as he rode his horse through the high water carrying the mail, said, "Yes, the dam went out at Hillsboro is the reason we have all this water," not recognizing the fact that there's a 600-foot ridge between here and Hillsboro. But to him, obviously, with his water, all had to come because the dam went out at Hillsboro. But in the wintertime, he had the most unusual vehicle to carry his mail in. It had begun life as a pair of runners and a piano box. Now, pianos were shipped into Richland Center in crates, and the crates were probably 3.5 feet wide and 6 feet high and 7 feet long. so that they made a sort of a big box. And Jim had gotten one of these piano boxes, and he had mounted it on this set of runners, and so that he could use a team of light horses. I guess that was the term that was used at that time. They were light, small, fast horses. He could use this team of light horses on this sled, and he could sit in his piano box. And a chicken house window had been salvaged and put across the front for a windshield, and there had been a slot cut underneath it so that the lines would reach out. And on the side of this, one side had a window so that the light came in, and I expect Jim could read the postcards as he went from between stops. And the other side was an old binder canvas. And binder canvases are broad sheets of canvas with slats alternately placed about 6 inches apart so that you could roll it up if the weather was good. But if it was real cold, you could let it all unroll down. And here you were encased in this beautiful little contraption, and you had all the comforts. There was no air conditioning, but and there was no heater. And if you have ever ridden in buggies, I'm sure that there was behind a team of moving horses that there were a certain amount of air pollution comes back your way. But he was far ahead of his time, and neither slow, rain nor sleet nor dead of night in any sense would impair the delivery of the mail. The mail went through. Jim was also, I think, town chairman, and perhaps maybe at some time or other assessor, but I guess probably he was the chairman, because I remember once that there was a terribly big high water, and somehow or other Jim got the ballots, and he rode a horse through the high water and sat in the townhouse with the ballots all day and voted his ballot. And that was the only ballot at election that particular time in the town of Rockbridge, because the high water had kept everybody else from coming. The post office eventually got moved down to Jack Cunningham's store. Now, this was one of the things that happened, you know. It was to have the post office in your store brought in people. They had to come and get their mail. If they came to buy their mail, they'd probably buy their groceries. And so the post office sort of got tossed around rather in a relationship to whatever political party happened to be in power in Washington. And apparently why the post office got moved from up to the Oddfellows Hall, and it got moved down to Jack Cunningham's. I don't know whether Jack got the post office being a reward for being a Republican or a Democrat. I have no idea as to how this happened, but Jack Cunningham's store was a very small little store inside. You could just swing the door open and step in, and there was a aisle down the middle to the big coffee grinder at the end, and on the left was the counter and the showcase was candy and some pipes and that sort of thing. Probably, I don't think that even bread was an article of sale yet at that time. I don't think bakeries were delivering bread to the local stores. But on the shelves were all the things that Roundy, Peckham, and Dexter provided for the country stores. And on the other side was the post office, and this was a cabinet full of little glass squares, behind which were little square boxes, in which has the, and out in front was the porch. And when the mail came by Mr. John Wallace, who was our mail carrier from Richland Center for many, many years, would come dashing into Rockbridge with his team of light horses on his buggy or on his sleigh, and carry the mail bags into the post office. And then Jack Cunningham and his daughter Jenny, who was his subordinate, would sort the mail and put it in the boxes, and they would give to the to John Wallace, the outgoing mail. This was one of the interesting things about the financial arrangements of the postal system at that time. Their wages were a proportion of the stamps that they sold. The outgoing mail was where they received their financial support from having the post office. It wasn't a very lucrative job to hold because in a place like Rockbridge, there wasn't a lot of outgoing mail. So they weren't not probably very well paid for their efforts. But of course, in the post office was always this bulletin board with the pictures of the on there of the fellow who were held up for a reward. $5,000 for locating Joe Doakes, who had held up the mail and so forth. And you were always looking at those pictures and just wondering, now, what would I do if I ran onto that guy? I don't think I would have done anything. I think I would have just forgotten that I ever saw him and let him go on by. Well, one of the characters in Rockbridge who had the post office and had the store was old Judd Kenyon. And he lived in the brick house where Dr. Hines later lived. Old Judd was a little short, square man, and had operated the store and had the post office too at one time. Later he sold his house to Dr. Hines. Dr. Hines was an established part of Rockbridge for many, many years. His name was Lester Hines, and he had been a country school teacher and had married a girl whose maiden name was Norman, and they were apparently happy, but she died, I think, probably in childbirth. I'm not certain of that, for their first child. And Dr. Hines was very depressed, and somebody suggested to him, why didn't he study to be a doctor? And so he went down to the medical school at Keokuk, Iowa, and he spent 6 months in the medical school at Keokuk, Iowa, and then went into for another 6 or 8 months into an internship in Rush Medical School in Chicago, and then came back to Rockbridge and set up shop as Rockbridge's doctor. And he was a very, very successful doctor. He was a short, chunky, jovial, heavy-set man, and he, at first, he first came to Rockbridge with his set up his office in the square house that Myron Schoonover lives in now. As I on the right-hand side of the road going up toward the Oddfellows building. After he came back and set up his shop as a doctor, he married Hattie Murray, and then they bought the house that had been the original post office in Rockbridge, or the original hotel, I should say, the original hotel in Rockbridge. And as a little boy, I would have to go to the doctor once in a while. And I would go and especially one of the times that I went to the doctor was when I was about the seventh grade, and they first were giving vaccinations for smallpox. Previous to this time, smallpox had been a real threat. And it was finally the authorities had come to the conclusion that if you would go and have a vaccination, the county would pay for your vaccination. And this was pretty well told in school, and I was probably in the third or fourth grade, and I got impressed, and I got my courage screwed up to go into Dr. Hines's and have a vaccination. And all the way up there, as I remember trudging up the road through the dust, as the kind of roads that we had were not hard surfaced at all, and the more traffic you had, the deeper the layer of silt on the top of the highway through the dust, and just hoping beyond hope that Dr. Haynes wasn't there when I got there. But he was there, and he said, yes, come into his office. And to go into Dr. Haynes's office was a sort of a thrill of its own. He had a big stuffed owl in one corner, and I was always impressed with his owl. I swore that his eyes could move, move and follow you wherever you went, but it really was a stuffed owl. And there was a smell of a doctor's office that is unique in itself. I guess it's mostly composed of carbolic acid. It's the disinfectants that were used, and carbolic acid was one of the common ones. And then to go into Dr. Haynes's office, and first you were in the waiting room with a pot-bellied stove, and then you walked through into the office. And one of the things that Dr. Haynes had in his office was a skeleton all wired together back in the corner. Boy, this just simply about blew me away when I looked at that skeleton and thought, well, here's the remains of a human being, and probably sometime this is all there will be left to me, and these are the parts that hold me together, and there's my jaw, and there are my shoulder blades, and I was really astounded to observe Dr. Haynes's skeleton. Well, Dr. Haynes came out when he to do my vaccination, and I had a picture, you know, of somebody from the physiology book, where they said that they cut an area off your arm, they dug into the arm, and they made an opening, and then they put the material for the what's the word I'm using, Mark? Inoculation. They put the material for the inoculation in this hole. Well, when Dr. Haynes came out, he pulled my arm across the table, and he began to wash it with alcohol to disinfect it, and then he took a little tiny needle and he scratched the surface just very, very lightly, until eventually a little drop of blood appeared on it. And I had hardly felt it at that point, although I was just shivering because I knew this was only the beginning, and I could almost think my arm was going to be taken off. And then he opened a little of his case in which he had all his pills and bottles and vials, and he took one out and he broke it, and a little drop of serum came out, and he laid that on the surface and gave it probably a minute and a half to be absorbed, and put a bandage on my arm, and that's all there was, the inoculation, I thought. The next morning my arm was sore, and for probably a 10-day time my arm was almost stiff, and I did get quite a reaction from the inoculation, although they said always that this was the thing which proved to you that you were inoculated. If your body reacted to those germs which were in the serum and did battle with them and vanquished them, then you had the antibodies that would protect you from the disease. Dr. Haynes was doctor in Rockbridge for many, many years, and I often felt that what a compassionate man he must have been, and how hard it must have been for him to go out and witness the death of so many people and wish that you could do something. And so many of the things that he would have liked to have done then are so commonplace now. When I was in the store, I had a shelf, and on the shelf was enough antibiotics and penicillin that I sold out for people to doctor their sick horses and their sick cows and their sick calves. And I said, if Dr. Haynes had had that much penicillin in his shop, he'd have been a genius, because he was doing the very best he could with the material that he had. That little bag that he always carried around, a little square box about 14, 16 inches long, about 8 inches wide, 8 inches high, a little satchel, and in it were rows and rows and rows of bottles of pills. Doctors didn't give you a prescription and then to go down to the drugstore and get filled. The doctors just kept the pills right with them, and they took out a little envelope and put the pills in the envelope and took their pencil and write on them. Take two at night and one in the morning for 5 days, and this was the prescription they were giving. In fact, we didn't even have aspirin at that time. What is it that I'm thinking of that they used during the Civil War so much to battle the fevers? Quinine. This was one that Dr. Hines gave quite a lot. It was quinine, the different fevers that people had. He had a horse and a road cart, which is a two-wheeled cart, which he traveled with in the spring, and then his horse and buggy. And as he got older, he bought an automobile, and he had a very nice wagon and light wagon, buggy type, and a very fine team of light horses. But he felt that he could hire somebody to be his driver. And so I know Buford Schoonover for quite a few years worked for Dr. Hines, and he took care of the horses and did the driving, and Dr. Hines would just sit in the buggy and ride out to wherever the patient was, and Buford would take care of the horses and have to wait until Dr. Hines had made his diagnosis. And sometimes these were childbirth and they took long times, and Buford would have to wait a long time, and Dr. Hines would have to wait a long time because he had very little support. When I was five, I fell on the ice and rather confused my right elbow. It was broken and dislocated and had to be something more done with it. And Dr. Hines tried very much to set it, and he decided that there was no way he could tell which direction the pieces went in there. So he got his driver, Buford Schoonover, to hold me in his lap, and Dr. Hines and my dad and mother went to Richland Center, and the only x-ray in Richland Center was in the dentist's office, Dr. Vogel. So I was taken upstairs to Dr. Vogel's office and had a x-ray of my elbow using the dental x-ray. And then Dr. Hines and Dr. Doherty and Dr. Vogel, all three of them, assembled the sorted pieces and clamped them back together and put my arm in a elbow splint. And they made a sling for me to carry it, they did a reasonably good job. It has a certain amount of curvature to it, but it's never given me any difficulty at all. I lived with it all my life very well, even though it hangs a little awkwardly on one side. It's not noticeable at all. Dr. Hines, yes, Mark.
The kid is his tape one.
Dr. Hines I'm sure a good diagnostic. What's the word I want to say? Diagnostician. Diagnostician. That's a hard one, Mark. But really, which had come from a lot of hard experience. One of our neighbors who lived across the river was Jess Holloway, and Jess Holloway had I'm sure was in a weakened condition because of having been an alcoholic. But Dr. Hines came over from there, and he said to my dad, "Well, I hate to tell you, but Jess Holloway's going to die," and. Dad said, "Oh, that's too bad. I want to go over and see if there's anything that I can do." And well, doctor said, "He'll be dead by 8 o'clock." So my dad just rushed right over, and Jess Holloway was sitting up in bed. Dad came home and he said, "Well, I sure don't understand why Dr. Hines has decided that Jess Holloway will be dead by 8 o'clock, but by 8 o'clock, Jess Holloway was dead." His heart had just given out. Dr. Hines was had enough experience to know that he could just last a certain length of time with due to the heart condition that he and the pneumonia and the whole bit that he had. It must have been a tragedy for doctors to have to treat diphtheria without the medicines that we have. And I'm sure that, that the flu epidemic that struck after in 1919 after World War I must have just been tragic for doctors because death was so prevalent. Up on the other, our what we always call the Wall Farm, which is where my daughter Marilyn's house is now, and there's a family lived there by the name of Walls, Gardner Wall, and they had migrated here from Upper New York State. I don't know. Well, many years before, because the Wall children had gone to Rockbridge School when my mother was going to Rockbridge School. So this must have been 1906 or 7 or somewhere at that time, or maybe even 4 or 5 years before that. But the Walls, there was Gardner Wall, a little short, hunchback sort of man, and his wife, whom I just vaguely remember having gone over the hill with my dad squirrel hunting and came by Wall's house, and Mrs. Wall came out on the porch and gave us a drink of water or in some way made herself known to us. So I do remember Mrs. Wall. There were three sons, Frank, Charlie, and Fred. And Fred was a rather retarded sort of a fellow, a big, ungainly, overgrown type of fellow without having had much education. But Charlie and the other brother had both married and, as they said, moved up north. That was, actually, this was a part of the migration that was still taking place. There was very cheap land to be owned up in the area around Camp Douglas and Nacusa and Nisida and up in there. So Frank and Charlie had gone up north and bought land, and they had wives up there. Well, in the, when the flu epidemic came along in 1919, the Wall family got the flu like everybody else did. And one of the brothers and his wife came home to take care of Mrs. Wall. And the brother and his wife just contracted the flu and just very shortly died. The other brother and his wife came to take care of Mrs. Wall. And just in a few days, the flu had taken them too. And then Mrs. Wall died. There were 5 deaths within just a matter of even two or three weeks in that family. And nobody was left there but old Gardner and Fred. And they lived on the farm. Trying to make a living, and the farm was greatly indebted to one of the banks in Richland Center, and the bank finally foreclosed on it, and they had a sale, and they sold what little merchandise, what little personal property they had, a few cows, and probably a team, and maybe a wagon, and probably gave their household goods away, which probably didn't amount to much in the first place. And then these 2 decrepit old people got down to Richland Center and got on the train and headed back to York State, where they had migrated from here probably 25 years before. And I thought how well I would like to know what was the end of the story, what became of Gardner Wall and what became of Fred. And they went back to York State. Well, okay.
When you pick your glasses,
it comes.
I have to either edit it out if I were to use it. It's real close to the microphone.
Yeah. Well, let's see. Who else can I talk about, Mark?
Well, let's see. You've talked about the post office.
There's
got to be blacksmiths, and you have the garage.
Shall I talk about the school? Yeah, that the school is a whole story. Yes, the school is a story. It's really a part of our lives. My grandfather, my great-grandfather, was Tillis Knapp, and I don't know who his my great-grandmother was. But somewhere in that family, there was a great deal of respect for learning, because my grandmother and her three sisters were all people who had high intellect and were, for the opportunity they had had, were very well educated. They had all been country school teachers and at various places, some of them in other parts of the county, and one of them even down in Grant County. But they were very intelligent people. And my grandmother had taught the last term of school in Rockbridge in the old log school. And the old log school sat over where Arthur Simpson's garage does. And she told me something about it. I don't believe that it was made entirely of logs. I think, as she described it, it was sided with slabs. You know, the slabs that they cut off of the sides of the... And it was a frame building, and we didn't have... You didn't have siding to side the buildings with, so they had slided it up and down over the frame that had been built with slabs. Grandma had taught the last term of school in that in 1881, and then she taught, went over to the so-called new school, which was the school that lasted in Rockbridge here for from 1981 till 1965, probably. She went over and taught the first term of school in that new school. And in the meantime, Grandpa Carpenter, my mother's father, had his first wife had died and had left him with, I think, five or six children. And Grandma was the old maid school teacher who lived in Rockbridge. And Grandpa was an eligible widower who needed a wife. So Grandpa and Grandma were married and had a rather strange relationship. She always called him Mr. Carpenter. His name was Silas, and I wondered even in times when they were totally alone, if she insisted on always calling him Mr. Carpenter. But I never heard him call her call my grandfather anything but Mr. Carpenter. And my Mr. Carpenter, my grandfather, was Silas Carpenter, and he had been to the Civil War and had come back and had taken up, I had supposed, a land grant. He and his buddy Newton Jesmore had taken up the grant for 160 acres, which is just south of Rockbridge here now. But I find out in reading my deeds that it first belonged to a speculating company down in Grant County, down at Dodgeville. A speculator in Dodgeville had bought a block of land here, and Grandpa, for his efforts in the Civil War, had received what was known as a bounty. And a bounty was a certain amount of credit that could be applied to picking up a homestead after the war. So he and Newt put their bounties together, and they picked up this 160 acres, and Grandpa took the north half, and Newt took the south half. And so here were these two old Civil War buddies living side by side. And Grandpa was a carpenter by name and by trade. And I think Grandpa was generally known as a good man. I never have just figured out just exactly what he was good for, because he didn't accumulate any great amounts of Earth's treasures at all. He lived across the road from the store here now and built a house, and he and my grandmother lived there, and my grandmother took care of his children from his first family, and my mother was born, and she went to the Rockbridge School, and Grandpa built houses up and down the valleys here as a carpenter. not a lot of them, I don't think. I think he was just a very quiet, easygoing, very untroubled sort of man. Well, coming back to the Rockbridge School, my grandma had taught there the first term of school, and then my mother went to the school, and when I was old enough to go to school, that's where I started going to school. I started when I was 5, and I think I lasted something like 15 or 17 minutes, and nobody brought me anything to do, and I became a little bit frustrated, and so I burst out the door, and I didn't go back until next year. And then the next year, my mother had taught me a lot of things, and so even though I went back into the first grade, in the middle of the year, I went into the second grade. So I moved up along as rapidly as if I had stayed there when I was 5, which is not a good thing for it to happen to anybody, really, being the youngest one of your class all the way through school is not a happy situation. If you could be the average age of your class or a little on the older side, you have a great deal more self-confidence than you do when you're the little one in the class always. And I was always the little one in my class, even into high school, and really never was very confident of myself until I got to teacher's college. Then when one of my teachers in school was my first teacher was Violet Boyle, a local family up Snow Valley, their daughter, and then Charlie Chismore, who was the son of Old Newton, who was my grandfather's Civil War buddy, and Charlie was a teacher here for second or third grade. He moved into Madison and became, I'm not sure whether he was postmaster, but at least he was in the postal department at Madison for the rest of his life. I had Esther Dosh, who was my cousin as a teacher in about the fourth grade. I had Catherine Hyatt, who was my teacher in about the fifth grade. And then I had Bill Brathwaite for my teacher for the last 3 years. Bill Brathwaite was a very good teacher. He had an appreciation of pictures, an appreciation of poetry, appreciation of culture in general, which you were taught more than reading, writing, and arithmetic. You were really taught culture. And the poetry that Bill taught me to appreciate has been one of the happy things of my life. And I have so many poems that I can repeat, and when I'm sitting in church and the minister is preaching, I always say when I go out the door, well, you should have used this particular poem, because this is one that would have fit so well with your sermon. Then, of course, the school, I went there to school and graduated in the eighth grade, and went to high school and normal, teacher's college, and came back there and was the teacher there for 2 years. And strangely, some of the kids that were just getting out of the eighth grade were some of the ones that were just possibly getting into the first grade when I had been in school there before. But I enjoyed myself taking the Rockbridge School. It had 42 kids on the roll, 16 first graders, 42 of them in 8 grades. You had 15-minute classes, and it was very much like underwater swimming and at a swimming pool, because you just dived under the water and you swam full length of the pool, and you didn't raise your head nor take a breath. You just dived under at 9 o'clock, and you didn't come up again until recess. And you had a 15-minute recess, and then you dived under the water again, and you didn't come up until noon. And that was the sort of feeling that I had all the years that I taught school, that I was totally absorbed in what I was doing for those periods of time. There was no time for daydreaming, nor there was no radio to listen to, nor television to distract you. You were totally with your work. And I think that is perhaps one of the reasons that teachers in rural schools did such a good job. Generally speaking, that type of school was very successful. The year that I had 16 first graders, and we talk about being able to present ideas and get them accepted and absorbed and into the minds, I have often said that I would believe that everybody who is going to teach ought to teach one class of first graders, because you begin to realize the ability of the human mind to absorb, how well things have to be presented, how many times they have to be repeated before they finally are etched onto the memory to the point that you can regard that particular thing as having been learned and move ahead to something else. And it's a system that applies not only in teaching first graders to read, but it's the same principle in teaching, of regardless of what you're teaching, that you present the picture well and you make sure that it is repeated enough to have etched itself into the mind. Well, then when I was later was married and my children were ready to go to school, we lived on the farm, and I still have some moving pictures of taking Katie to school the first day in the Jeep and turning her loose in front of the schoolhouse door and going back at night and getting her. And I think I have pictures that I took of her coming out of the schoolhouse after her first day in school, and what an experience this was. So we have had a lot of connection with the Rock Ridge School. I'm glad it wasn't torn down. It's been converted into a house when the third Rock Ridge School was constructed. But I drive by the old school now, and I see the doorway across the front, which was the original doorway to the entryway into the school. And I see it's in my vision, it's 4 o'clock. The door suddenly opens and kids start coming out. And there I come running out, and my mother comes running out, and my daughters all come running out. And right behind them stands my crabby old grandmother, who was the first teacher in the school. So I visualize the whole group in my putting together my memories of that school.
What other businesses were there in town? You mentioned a hotel. What about blacksmiths?
To the best of my knowledge, Rockbridge never actually had a blacksmith shop that I know of. It must have had, but blacksmith shop we consider that the extent of shoeing horses. And most of the horse shoeing was done 2 miles up the road at Hub City. There was the village smithy up there. And in reading some of the old stories of Hub City, many of the people who came there were blacksmiths. To be a blacksmith was a real trade. That handling of hot iron and bending and welding is a real knack. And one of the things, of course, that had to be done was wheel repair. Now, Rockbridge had the Andersons. It had Charlie Anderson. Charlie Anderson was a builder. He could go out and somebody would cut. He would tell them what to saw in order to build a barn. How many 2x4s and how many 2x6s and how long the rafters should be and how many timbers for the side and how many timbers for the floor and all the things. And they would take Charlie's figures and have all in their logs and saw them. And this whole barn would be out there laid out on the ground in odd lengths and irregular cuts and everything, and then Charlie would appear with his blueprint, which I think he carried totally in his mind. I never saw him have one on paper, but he would start in measuring and marking off, and they had the boring machine. The boring machine was a thing that, well, it would look like a good exercise machine now. It had two cranks on it, which you took one in each hand, and a foot pedal for putting the pressure on the bit, and it had about a 2-inch auger, and you sharpened the auger, and then you made several holes side by side, and then you took a maul and a great big chisel, and you chiseled out that mortise. And then on the opposite piece, you marked off very carefully, and you sawed in so many inches on one side and so many inches on another side and so many inches on the other side until you made a tenon that would fit into that mortise. Then you did some boring in which you made a hole in the tenon and a hole through the timber extending through the mortise, so that once you got this thing all put together, you could drive a pin. And so mortise and tenon were the way that the barns were being built. Everything would be all laid out. The rafters would be cut. Charlie would lay them all out. He was a wizard with a square. And the angles would be cut on the rafters, and the butts would be cut off at the rafters, and the top angles so that they would come together at the top. Then someday there would be the barn raising. Well, of course, you had to make the foundation, of course. And Charlie, while woodworking was his occupation, he would supervise the laying up of the stone. I don't think he did mason work. There were some other stone masons who came around whose job it was to just simply lay up the rock stone wall. Charlie would put the timber on the original timber on the wall that was where the barn was to set. Then someday there would be a barn raising. You'd lift up this timber and insert it into the tenon into its mortise, and Charlie had a whole lot of pins all cut and tapered and pointed, and you would stick a pin in the hole and drive it in with a sledge, and little by little the frame of the barn went up, and then the rafters were put up, and then the sheeting came up, and eventually the men were up there on the very top of it shingling it. And another group of men were putting the siding on, usually a vertical up and down siding, sometimes with rough lumber, sometimes with lumber that was bought at the lumber yard. But for a man to have this ability to visualize in his mind and be able to visualize different sizes and structures and buildings with different characteristics, those men are geniuses, and Charlie Anderson was really, really a genius. He had for the time that he wasn't running, was building, he had the thrash machine, and his original thrash machine was a big steam engine, but he was a little more advanced than that, and he bought an advanced Rumley, which is a big old oil pull with that burned diesel fuel, and they would go from farm to farm. The old Rumley would come bumbling down the road, pulling the thrasher behind it, and then they would take it out back of the man's barn and perhaps put the blower so that the blower went up in the barn if you wanted to blow your straw in the barn, or if you were going to blow it out on the outside to set up an area where you were going to want to have a straw stack. And then, of course, the oats had been cut by the binder and put in shocks, and there would be a matter of probably 10 teams and wagons, and probably 6 or 8 men out in the field with pitchforks throwing it onto the wagons. And if you were one of those with the team and wagon, why, you drove out there and you loaded to some extent, and you got a load, and you went in and you pulled in beside the thrash machine, and your hope that the team of horses you were driving were patient enough to stand there beside of that terrible rumbling thrash machine in the midst of all that dirt. And then you started throwing it into the hopper, or into the feeder, and it was shaken. It was mulched and shaken, and eventually the grain came off the chute on the side and into the sacker, and the other end, the blower, blew out the straw, and if you were up in the barn, why, somebody had to go up in that barn and move it around, otherwise it would pile up in one spot. Somebody had to mow it away, or if you put it into a stack outside, somebody had to stack it. Seemed to me I always got stuck with that barn duty or that stacking duty, because, and dirty, you can imagine the dirt that would be blown through that blower and into that stack, and you had to walk around in that dirt and breathe it, which is actually, there would, in our present understanding of the people that have farmers and lung and that sort of thing, we would pass a law against having that kind of an operation because it was so hazardous. I know I used to work on that straw pile, and for several days after that, I would cough and wheeze and cough up just simply black soot, black silt out of my lungs. And I eventually ended up with asthma as a result of that running the thresh machine. It was a little difference in the places that you went. Some of the men who you were thrashing for were very temperate-minded people, and they wouldn't let them bring any liquor on the place. But once in a while, they went to a place where the guy really liked to pass the liquor around, and they had some pretty hazardous and high times at some of the thrashing meets. And it wasn't really the safest thing in the world to be working around a bunch of fellows with a dangerous machine like a thrash machine when the engineer was unable to operate it and slow it down or stop it if there was an emergency. So it was a little hazardous sometimes. But this was Charlie Anderson was the thrasher, and Charlie Anderson was the barn builder. Across the street was his brother,